Good morning. My name is Ian Bruch, Chief Investment Officer of the Trust Company. Welcome to our August 6th edition of our Public Asset Management Committee call. Thanks so much for joining us. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. And you can see our website for full disclosures. Well, as always, I'm joined by our broader investment group, which includes Timothy Vick here in our Naples market. We have Ed Siskowski, Gary Dyer, Joel Johnson, and Craig Holston out on Sanibel. And up in our Tampa market, we have Brianna McDougall and Andrew Vanderhorst. So a quick coronavirus update, just to share the numbers with everyone in terms of where we stand. We're at 18.7 million cases globally since this pandemic began, but that really only equates to about 6.7 million active cases. So we think that's an important number because when you hear the large number, you assume that that's how many people are currently infected, but that's not the case. This is since the beginning. Here in the U.S., 4.9 million cases since the beginning, about 2.3 million active cases here in the U.S. right now. More localized, we continue to see improvements in some of the hardest hit states over the last month, namely Florida, California, Arizona. We've seen just in the past week or two that rate of growth every day come down, which is obviously good news. So those states continue to be impacted. But it's nonetheless good to see that after about a month of some worrisome signs in terms of new cases, we're starting to see that data sort of top out and roll over. So let's keep our fingers crossed that that continues across the hardest hit states here in the U.S. From an economic standpoint, we did receive unemployment claims, as we always do every Thursday morning. Those came in much better than expected at 1.186 million, so 1,186,000 new unemployment claims. About 1.4 million was expected this morning. And so that was a handily better than what consensus expectations were, which is obviously a good sign. And frankly, we've been hovering in that 1.4 to 1.5 million unemployment claim level since early June. So to get a 1.1 million number is clearly a good sign. But let's also not lose sight of the fact that 1 million unemployment claims is still a historically very high number. And if we just think back to prior to coronavirus, the highest weekly unemployment claim number was around 600,000. And that was back in the 2008-2009 economic crisis. So the fact that we're still getting a million claims a week, even though it's better than expected, is still a pretty alarmingly high number. So we'll continue to keep an eye on that. We will be getting a new unemployment rate tomorrow. We're hovering at 11.1% currently. The expected number tomorrow is 10.5%. So feel free to keep that kind of number in your mind as the news media reports unemployment. 10.5% is the expectation for tomorrow, and we'll see where that shakes out tomorrow morning. We did receive a client question or a question from a caller, and I'll just read this briefly. If the pandemic lasts well into next year, as now seems probable, what will be the likely effect on the economy and financial markets? First off, I'd say we would agree with your assertion that the pandemic is most likely going to last well into next year. It seems like we're probably not going to be fully out of the woods until a vaccine is developed at this point. The likely impact on the economy and the financial markets, I do tend to think we've seen the worst in terms of financial market impact back in March when we really created this self-imposed shutdown. It seems very likely that we're not going to go that route again, even if we do get a new increase in cases come flu season, which is probable given that we've seen increases throughout the summer in some states. So we're of the same mind that we're going to be dealing with coronavirus for several more months and probably into next year. But we do think that the worst has been felt from an economic and a market standpoint at this point. That's not to say that it's smooth sailing from here. We touch on unemployment every week, and we think that it's going to take significantly longer than probably most people expect for unemployment to get back to what we were enjoying before coronavirus. And that's going to just create choppiness in the overall economic underpinning of our country. And so financial markets are a part of that. So it just ties back to let's make good long-term investment decisions when we're picking companies and bonds to purchase on behalf of our clients. I did want to just segue into earnings. We're going to spend the majority of this call touching on earnings reports. At this point, over 75% of the S&P has reported earnings for the second quarter, and 84% of the companies that have reported have beat their expectations. And I think there's a good reason for that, which is, you know, coming out of March and April, everybody slashed expectations considerably. And what we've seen is some sequential improvement month over month in the numbers. So for a lot of these businesses, the month of April looked better than the month of March. The month of May looked better than April. The month of June looked better than May. And so we continue to see that monthly improvement. We're still at pretty low levels, and the earnings reports at face value do not look pretty, but that was largely expected. So the fact that we've had earnings beats is just a reflection of how much earnings expectations are really slashed in the earlier part of the year. We've noted that just across all the companies that have reported, a few consistent themes have been cost control measures, so companies really trying to rein in costs to support earnings. And then on the flip side, there's obviously been increased coronavirus-related cost pressures that have come about for different companies as well. So with that said, let's get into some individual earnings reports. And Craig, if I could start with you, could you just give us a brief update on what Disney had to say? Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Ian. Good morning, everybody. Disney, which we know is the global entertainment company, it reported on Tuesday that they lost $4.7 billion in the 3 months ending June 27th. This compares to a profit of $1.3 billion last year. Total revenue fell 42% to $11.8 billion. By the way, this is the first quarterly loss of Disney since early 2001, when they lost $570 million. So it's pretty rare for them to have a non-profitable quarter. Obviously, the pandemic is an extreme example. Just some background, Disney operates under four main operating segments: parks, experiences and products, media networks, studio entertainment, and direct-to-consumer. Now, that's the internet content streaming business, which we're going to talk about. As expected, the Disney Parks and Experience business was hit the hardest, with almost a $2 billion loss for the quarter versus a profit of $1.7 billion a year ago. During the quarter, the domestic parks, resorts, cruise lines, and Disneyland Paris were closed during the entire quarter. Only Shanghai Disney and Hong Kong Disney were able to operate for a portion of the quarter. Because parks usually represent about 30% of company revenues under normal times, it's important to monitor the progress of a safe reopening. And I know we were just talking internally about some people that had visited Disney, and they said it's such a pleasurable experience because there's no lines. So it's great for the visitor, but not great for the earnings. Revenues for the media networks, which include ESPN and ABC Network, we're only down 2% in the quarter, but operating income from this segment actually increased by 50%. So this is a real strange phenomenon. Disney management explained that because the NBA and Major League Baseball seasons were shut down, ESPN basically deferred the cost of producing live sports and sent it to next quarter. And the NBA and baseball are now back on live TV in a limited capacity. Those production and rights costs will show up next quarter. So this appears to be just a one-time benefit. It's a similar story over at ABC, which they own. Broadcasting operating income increased 55% in the quarter because production of popular shows like The Bachelorette, I think that's one of Joel's favorites, and American Idol were shut down due to COVID. Again, with some production ramping back up, those programming and production costs will show up in the next earnings report. The studio entertainment segment had revenues decreased by 55% to $1.7 billion due to lower theatrical releases, as theaters were generally closed both domestically and internationally. There were no blockbuster titles released in the quarter compared to last year when Avengers Endgame, Aladdin, and Dark Phoenix were released. So those were big hits, and now with no production and no releases, obviously that segment's going to suffer. Now, the one segment that investors in Disney seemed to focus on the quarter was the direct-to-consumer business. This segment represents streaming services Disney Plus, ESPN Plus, and Hulu, which Hulu is a joint venture with Comcast. Disney owns 66% of that. ESPN Plus allows subscribers to stream live sports content, actually had higher income because of some UFC, Ultimate Fighting Championship pay-per-view events, which – took place without audience members. Now, Disney Plus, which was launched just last November, already has 60 million paid subscribers. That's just an amazing number in a short period of time. Disney will be launching a similar service in their international markets, so that's really some great potential. The big headline out of Disney Plus was that the announcement that the long-delayed live-action feature Mulan will be available as a pay-per-view option exclusively on Disney Plus for $30. This is going to take place on September 4th in places where movie theaters remain closed. So if the countries actually have their movie theaters reopened, Mulan will be released in theaters. So this is huge for stay-at-home parents with little kids, and for $30, it seems expensive, but I would imagine that would be very successful. Now, this decision to put Mulan on pay-per-view raises the question of whether this strategy is a one-time response to the pandemic, or as Disney chief executive Bob Chapek seems to suggest on the call, this is just a one-off sort of situation, or is it a sign of a permanent shift in the movie distribution business? Now, either way, movie theater operators cannot be happy with this announcement. So that's something we have to watch. The bottom line for Disney investors, like many of our companies Ian mentioned, is how quickly can the parks and experience segment recover from this pandemic? When will people be comfortable with going out, getting on an airplane, staying at a hotel, and visiting places like the parks? But one takeaway is that as the streaming business of Disney continues to be a bigger part of the company's bottom line, you know, Disney just may be less reliant on the legacy theme park business over time. And that's really what we're going to be watching. Back to you, Ian.
Yeah, thank you, Craig. I think Disney is a good example of my intro comments on some of the earnings numbers we've seen. I mean, here you had a company that reported historically bad numbers, I think the stock was up 8 or 9% on that report, just a reflection of consensus expectations going into the quarterly results have become so depressed that even the historically bad numbers that they reported were better than what everybody expected. So the stock rose on that news. So thanks for that update, Craig. Ed, I'll switch it over to you if you could cover a few of your quarterly earnings announcements for us. Thank you.
Sure, Ian. Good morning, everyone. Hope everyone's well. We had a couple biotech companies report and Apple. So first on Amgen. Amgen's arguably the most successful biotech company of all time. For about 4 or 5 years, the top line was flat as it needed to have its R&D pipeline mature. That has been happening. They've had a number of stocks in phase three that have been granted approval. Early indications are they're ramping faster than expected. They have a couple more phase threes, one for heart failure and another for severe asthma in second half of this year, I think fourth quarter. So those are potential positive readouts for later in the year and potentially increases in revenue expectations for next year. They beat and they raised. Street remains a little bit ahead of them. This is not new news to people on Wall Street. Stock has moved from about 180 to 250 from the low in March to now. But the expectation is that revenues should continue accelerating. Basically, it was flat to mid-single digits to high single digits over time. And this is a $25 billion company with 22 commercialized products at present and several more coming down the pipeline. They did mention COVID impact, where there has been some reticence on the part of some patients to maintain regular contact with their physicians and maintenance. So that has, in spite of the really good numbers, COVID did have an impact. So things would have been even better as the quarter went on had we not had COVID. Balance sheet solid, dividend is real stable. So we liked that quarter. We had Alexion report. Alexion beat and raised. That might be the 12th or 13th quarter in a row that they beat and raised. They're growing top line organically about 10 or 11%. Big news in the quarter. Alexion, just so that everyone knows, this is a company that provides biotech products for ultra rare and rare diseases. Think about diseases that are kind of measured in 5,000 to maybe as many as 10,000 people globally. These are things you probably haven't even heard of, like AHAS, PNH, MG. Those are just abbreviations for names with lots of consonants and vowels. But they're a leader in this, and it's called complement inhibition. And the complement is a part of your immune system that produces or enhances, therefore the complement part, antibodies which attack microbes in your systems or various pathogens that are damaging cells. Like anything in your system, the complement system can be overexpressed, properly expressed, or underexpressed. When it's overexpressed, that means it's acting too much when it's not necessary, and these drugs prevent that from happening quite successfully. Many times in these diseases, it's for young people, very young people. But the good news in the quarter was the second generation of their major therapeutic, Soliris, it's called Ultomiris. They had hoped to get a conversion of patients to 65% by year end, and they converted 70% of people to the new generation by the end of that quarter. So that's really good news. The drug is priced a little bit less. These are high priced drugs, but they priced Ultomiris at a discount to Soliris to enhance the conversion. Ultomiris is patented out to the mid 2030s. So that's a really good thing. But the real benefit of the drug, and on top of the fact that it has better safety and efficacy profiles, is its dosing pattern. Instead of dosing this drug every other week for 4 or 5 hours in a physician's office, they were able to change the molecule such that dosing occurs every other month, and it takes 45 minutes. So from someone that's burning 24 days a year to going down to just 6 hours a year, that's just substantial. There are biosimilars out there. We don't have a lot of data on it. Again, that's really hard to get patients into a protocol simply because of COVID. But those biosimilars aren't likely to hit the market until 2025. And by then, Ultomiris will be the standard of care, not Soliris, which these biosimilars are going after. So we like that here. The last company report was Apple. Apple had a fantastic quarter. Revenue grew organically almost 11%. It was expected to be down slightly year over year. Again, they provided no guidance. Earnings were 258 versus 218. Very, very solid. There's good news and there's bad news associated with it. The good news is they blew things out much higher than expected. The bad news is that's going to create a heck of a comp a year from now. And the reason why that's interesting is because of what drove the quarter. Basically, you had solid iPad growth, solid computer growth, the Mac growth, and you had solid iPhone growth. You had people sitting at home not spending any discretionary funds at all. So not visiting theme parks, not visiting any sporting events, not visiting any restaurants, not even driving their cars. So all of this discretionary income went into updating your phone, buying a new MacBook Pro, getting a new iPad. And you don't do that every year. So bottom line is we think Apple's going to have another couple good quarters, but then we'd be a little bit cautious next year. Stock also happens to be trading 33% higher than the highest valuation it ever achieved, which was back in 2008. So a lot of this good news is currently in Apple. Nevertheless, the quarter was very good, and the next couple quarters probably should be good too. Back to you, Ian.
Great. Thank you, Ed. Let's keep going here. Gary, I'm going to send it over to you for some more quarterly earnings announcements. Thanks.
Thanks, Ian, and good morning, everyone. McKesson is a company we follow, and they recently reported first quarter results ending June 30th. And for those of you that may not know, McKesson is the largest drug distributor in the U.S., and they move branded and generic drugs from the manufacturer to the retailer. And in the first quarter, revenues and earnings per share solidly beat expectations, with sales being flat versus last year and earnings per share down about 16% year over year. But I think more importantly, management actually raised earnings per share guidance by quite a bit for the full year period ending March 31st of next year. and they actually projected an increase year over year of 1% on earnings versus last year. So in other words, management actually foresees a considerable pickup in their earnings over the next three quarters of the fiscal year to offset that drop in the first quarter. And in addition to that, McKesson finished the quarter with over $2.6 billion in cash on its balance sheet. The board actually increased its dividend during the quarter, and they have plenty of room to raise the dividend since it's only paying out about 10 to 15% of its profits in the way of dividends. And McKesson is also trading at the very low end of its five-year forward four-quarter P.E. ratio, and it's only 10 to 11 times earnings. So this ratio is in line to lower than its peers, which are Cardinal Health and AmerisourceBergen, and it is substantially lower than the overall equity market. Now, a few weeks ago, we compared the performance and the valuation metrics of Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. And this week, I wanted to review the second quarter results of the third largest beverage company in North America, and that's Keurig Dr. Pepper. Keurig is another company that we keep a close eye on, and they had a absolutely stellar second quarter, especially in comparison to those peers. Keurig slightly beat Wall Street estimates, and their sales and earnings per share were actually higher year over year by 3% and 10% respectively. Now, the hot beverage and at-home cold beverage categories reported outstanding mid to high single-digit volume growth in the quarter, partly driven by market share gains and new product introductions. Now, as expected, the away-from-home fountain beverage segment experienced a year-over-year decline in sales and profits, but it is a much smaller segment of the company's sales and operations in comparison to Coke and Pepsi. Now, while Keurig Dr. Pepper continues to be leveraged after its 2018 merger, the company continues to generate a very healthy amount of free cash flow, and they actually paid down over $250 million in debt in the quarter while still paying out a healthy dividend, which equates to a yield of about 2%. Now, as it did in the last quarter, management reaffirmed full-year guidance with the consensus Wall Street estimate projecting year-over-year sales and earnings per share growth of 3 and 15% respectively. Now, given the company's growth rate and its valuation metrics in comparison to Coke and Pepsi and versus the overall market, Dr. Pepper appears to be actually slightly undervalued versus the overall market and those peers. Back to you, Ian.
Great. Thank you, Gary, for that summary. Just as a reminder, we do this every Thursday. My email address is on the invitation that you received for this call, so feel free to send in questions as they come, and we'll address them on this call. Thanks so much for joining us this week, and we'll be back same time, same place next week. Keep an eye out for the email for the phone call next week. Thanks so much, and have a good rest of your week.